Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Russ Avison right here on LA Talk Radio.
It is another beautiful Thursday evening in Southern California, and I haven't heard anybody say, God, we need rain in the last month. They're actually going to fill Silver Lake, the mud hole.
Yeah.
Wow, that's something. Well, we got enough rain, now we can fill Silver Lake. Hi, Russ, how are you?
I'm wonderful, Jimmy. How are you?
I am well. My name is Jim Christina. I'm your host, and this is LA Talk Radio, and of course you're listening to The Writer's Block. And Writer's Block is brought to you by Black Dog Publishing, a little Black Dog Publishing in Simi Valley. And if you're a new writer that really don't know how to navigate your way through, give us a call. The number there is 805-795-3165. And the nice folks at Black Dog will kind of walk you through it. And Out West, and it used to be Out West Boutique and Cultural Center, but now it's just Out West. And they are your online source for top brands that are a reflection of the equestrian and Western lifestyle. So shop for unique and distinctive apparel, boots, hats, fashion, accessories, home decor, books, music, and general merchandise. National brands include Scully, Rockmount, Ranchwear, Dan Post Boots, and American West Handbags, just to name a few. Give them a call at 877-340-9378, and they will be happy to give you a hand. And, of course, by our good friends at Target Freight Management. And since 2009, Target Freight has had a full truckload service that's the best in the industry. They go to great lengths to secure the most competitive rates possible. TFM also provides unmatched customer support from their dedicated truckload division. In an effort to streamline our customers' overall shipping efficiency, TFM provides real-time updates on all lanes. Call TFM today and get a hold of Mike Matruski. They're a nice man, and he'll really help you out. Their number there is 844-653-7789. Tell him you heard it there in the Writer's Block, and they'll have a little something extra for you. And if you are an LTL shipper, LTL is?
Less than a truckload.
Oh, you're good, Russ. You're good. We know you're looking for the best rates with the least hassle. Call Target Freight Management. Their customized transportation management system is just the ticket to getting your freight moved your way. Call Target Freight Management today at 888-653-1323 or go to www.targetfmi.com on the web for both truckload and LTL. Call today. You won't be disappointed.
Wow.
What?
That was a lot.
It was. I know.
And you need to pay me more.
And I didn't screw it up. Tonight on the Writer's Block, we have a very special guest. And I have to say, this young lady went through hell. And I have to say, it went through hell more than I would have liked to have gone through. And I'm just going to give you a little bit of her bio here. What's her name? Oh, never mind. I got it right here. Amanda Mahdi served 6 years in the United States Navy, including 3 years as an analyst at the National Security Agency, and a 2005 deployment to Iraq in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom. Following her separation from the military, she returned to the Middle East as a journalist and worked as a staff writer for the Amman, Jordan-based magazine covering the July 2006 Israel-Lebanon War. She is currently working on her next book, Voicing the Eagle, a de facto prequel to A Foreign Affair that tells her husband's story of being an Iraqi college student recruited right off his neighborhood street to translate for the U.S. forces throughout the course of the Iraqi War. Amanda holds a bachelor's degree in political science and currently resides in San Diego, California, with her husband, Fadi, and their two young daughters. And actually, she resides in El Cajon, but that's okay. Now, this is a story that transcends a love story, although it certainly is a love story, but it's more. It's a story about two people whose bond is so strong they were willing to take on the U.S. Navy and the Iraqi government, two people that managed to meet 10,000 miles apart and the total darkness of war. Would you please welcome to the Writer's Block Amanda Mahdi. Amanda, you still with us?
I'm still here.
Oh, good. Hello there.
We thought you might have backed out. You might have gotten nervous. We made you sound so wonderful.
I know. Sound wonderful, huh?
That can't be me.
It can and it was. And it is.
Surreal.
Okay. If you want to call and talk to Amanda tonight, there's got to be somebody who wants to talk to this young lady. She's got a wonderful story. The number here is 818-602-4929. That's 818-602-4929. I know we spoke the other day, Amanda, and I try to talk to everybody before they come on the show. I told you I was about three quarters of the way through your book, and right after we hung up, within the last, I'd say, 2 or 3 hours after I talked to you, I was done. I could not stop reading. So that's a testament
to
you.
That's a good sign.
It is a good sign. And Russ has told me when we were sitting in the studio before we went on the air that your descriptive talents are just phenomenal. And they really are.
Thank you, Russ.
They are. Well, I mean, you know, he's over here. He's gloating.
No, it was, as you described, just even from the start of the book, you describe you're going through this. It started out hellish because you had all these travels to get to Iraq took you, I don't know, it seemed like days. And every description of everything you endured as far as being on the plane, being in the net seats, it was crowded, it was smelly, it was hot, almost throwing up. I mean, I could imagine and picture everything that you went through, and it was wonderful.
Well, good. I'm glad that I was able to get that across.
and throwing up in the back of the CH-47 in the net hatch, that was pretty cool.
Yeah,
I have actually known people that have done that. Those things are smelly and they're loud and they're rattly. Ick. So let us in on a little secret. What I mean, you obviously went through this whole thing, and I mean, it's very apparent from your book that, you know, there was a lot of emotion involved in all of it. But what made you want to sit down and write this story out?
Well, I guess my situation was a little different in that the story, most authors, I guess, have to go find their story. My story found me. Mm-hmm. And I wrote it for stress relief. I started writing it a couple of months after I returned from Iraq and started going through the hell of being investigated for espionage. And I was in like this pressure cooker and I felt like I was going to explode. I had no release. I felt completely powerless and helpless. I mean, I was in the middle of being railroaded by the U.S. government. And I was like, I just want to tell my story, because I was sure at that time that I was going to end up in Leavenworth sharing a cell with, you know, Lindy. So I was like, well, before this happens, I am going to get my story down and I'm going to write it. And I needed, like I said, stress relief. So I started writing it for just to relieve stress. I never really, even at that point in time, was considering publishing it. It was a very personal story. It's kind of basically my diary. It took me, you know, about 6 years to finish the book. And even up until the point when I finished it, I mean, I was writing it for my kids. I was writing it for Fadi and for me. And then just some friends read it and, they said, you know, this is a really good story. You should try to have it published. And I said, oh, whatever. I literally like sent out some random emails to some random literary agents that I found online. And mm-hmm. I said, oh, whatever happens, happens. And one called me and said, I love your story. I want to represent you.
Wow.
And that would be Jeannie Loyacono.
Yes.
Okay.
She's stuck with me. She's gone through it with me as well, because writing the story, obviously living the story and writing the story was difficult. And then even getting the story published, I mean, it had to be approved by the NSA and the CIA. And right when I landed a publishing contract, the Edward Snowden scandal blew up.
Oh,
and
geez.
The people that I signed with backed out. Their lawyers were like, don't publish this girl's book.
Oh, my gosh. Let me ask you.
We're
going to talk more about the story itself.
Yeah.
But in reading this book, I have a very poor opinion of our political system and our government and the way it works now. And I, reading this book, it just seemed to really hammer home the truth of what I felt. What is your view on what's going on in Washington now, especially after having gone through all of this?
I have no view. No, I'm just kidding.
No, that's a loaded question.
Yeah.
Hey, I remember my training.
It's just between the three of us.
Yeah. Right. And 300,000 people.
Well, I mean, it's scary. We live in scary times, and we have been living in scary times. And, I mean, just the complete disorganization of Washington right now is, I don't know what other word to use, but scary. I mean, it's very unpredictable. And it's just one of those things. I think I, like a lot of people, are kind of sitting back and shaking our head going, you know, what's going to happen here and how is this going to turn out? Because it's not looking real good right now.
Do you think it's because the government's too big?
I mean, I'm a libertarian. so for me, the government's probably always going to be a little too big. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the government, we've been growing the government, not just, you know, Democrats have been growing it, but so have Republicans over the past century. And I think this is the hole that we've dug ourselves into. But I don't think people understand that a lot of the problems are spawning from the fact that the government is so huge and has so much power.
Well, I don't think the right hand, well, that's even an old cliche.
Right.
I don't think any part of the government knows what the other part of the government's doing all the time.
This is true. There's absolutely, a complete breakdown of communication, no communication.
Right.
Nobody really understands doesn't know what they're doing, even if they were told, they would have no clue. They don't understand.
No, they don't. And
so
you have a Speaker of the House that thinks that, you know, he keeps trotting off the same bill every 4 years with regularity. It's like clockwork. And it doesn't pass. And so he tries to shove it down everybody's throat. It doesn't pass. So it goes back in the closet for another 4 years. And I think that's what's going to happen again.
Well, and it gets to the point, too, you're like, is he really even trying, or is he just doing this as, you know, a political statement?
Well,
Does he know it's not going to go anywhere, or, you know, it's one of those things. And then there's so much, you know, undermining, and just, as a lot of people are saying, it's a circus.
Well, I think Paul Ryan is his own worst enemy. I really do. I'm not a big fan, nor am I a big fan of the president, incidentally. Russ, actually, when he was up in Canada when the elections were happening last November, and he was on the air with us, and he goes, well, you know, if I'd have known that Trump was going to win, I'd have turned around and gone back to Canada.
Gone the other direction.
Uh-oh.
All right, so why don't you give us kind of a little synopsis of your story. Because I know there's so many different components.
There
to it,
really
but,
is.
But just kind of give us a flow of what it's about.
Well, in 2005, I was in the U.S. Navy. I was a Russian linguist. I had been sent to the Defense Language Institute up in Monterey to learn Russian after Navy boot camp when I was 18. This was pre 9/11. 9/11 actually happened while I was in the middle of my Russian training. So I started kicking myself. Oh, why didn't I pick Arabic? yeah. So then I got sent to the National Security Agency. And of course, being a Russian linguist, in the middle of the Iraq war going on, we were basically on the back burner, twiddling our thumbs in the basement of the NSA because everything, you know, all eyes were on the Middle East at the time.
Sure.
And, I mean, I had joined the Navy, you know, right out of high school, you know, for adventure. Like, it's the typical 90s small-town America girl. I wanted to get out of my small town and go find adventure and travel the world. And at the time, you joined the military for college money and to travel the world. So that's why I had joined the military. And they never let me leave the continental United States. I was in for 5 years and still had never even seen a Navy ship. So the NSA was offering 4-month agency deployments to any military members that were working there to go to Iraq, just as a basic intel. They just needed people that had security clearances and a pulse, basically, and go over there and do liaison work. My actual title was Foreign Affairs Liaison Officer. And basically, our job was just to liaise between the new Iraqi government and the U.S. and coalition forces. And we were building a new intelligence service over there. We were fighting, of course, a very gruesome guerrilla urban warfare. The enemy wasn't wearing uniforms. We had very limited actionable intelligence that our troops were getting on the ground. so we were trying our best to kind of bolster that and build up our capabilities to collect intelligence and get it to our Marines and our soldiers on the ground. And the Iraqi government, of course, was helping us with that, and we were helping them because we were planning to hand this, you know, new intelligence agency over to them once we left, so that they would be able to assist their own troops. And then, of course, when I got stationed there, most of the Iraqi government employees speak Arabic. I did not speak Arabic, so I needed a translator. So my second night in the country, they said, here's your translator, and I met Fadi. And it was the cliched love at first sight for both of us. I thought it was a setup. I was like, really? This is who I'm going to be working with? And then over the next few months, we worked side by side, round the clock, you know, 6 days a week when you're in Iraq, there's not much time off. So a relationship grew while we were working together. We mostly worked in, like, you know, an office setting. So it was a typical, you know, like, office romance, I guess. And then we did do a forward deployment together out near the Syrian border, which was the front lines of the war at the time, with all the Al-Qaeda foreign fighters flowing across the border from Syria into Iraq. So we went out there to try to help collect intelligence out there from the Marines, because every time the Marines were leaving the wire at that point in time, somebody was dying. Al-Qaeda, a lot of the groups out there were, you know, doing coordinated, organized attacks. I mean, these weren't a bunch of, you know, sand people. They didn't know what they were doing. They were slaughtering Marines. They were doing it very skillfully. They were videotaping it, of course, and putting it on the internet, which was killing us that way. So we went out there to try to help in that aspect. And then, of course, being on the front lines together kind of grew our relationship even more. When you're in a situation like that with anybody, I guess you become closer. And then at the end of my time there, I got sent back to the U.S. And I knew at that point in time if our relationship, you know, was going to be beyond a summer fling. I knew because I had a top secret clearance, I said, you know, I'm probably going to have to choose between Fadi and my career, which I was totally ready to do. I was ready to walk away from my career and everything to be with Fadi and get him out of Iraq. He was in a lot of danger, having worked as a translator. He was receiving death threats from insurgency groups all the time. So I needed to get him out. But instead of just the Navy saying, okay, well, you can leave quietly, all of a sudden I found myself in an interrogation room with NCIS agents accusing me of espionage. They were saying that because of my relationship with Fadi, or they had learned, you know, that I had become close to my translator, and they just started throwing out everything. Everything in the kitchen sink was coming at me. Oh, you mishandled classified information. Oh, because of your relationship and your emotional attachment, you probably divulged things you weren't supposed to divulge, and, you know, clear up to espionage. They actually typed up my confession and laid it in front of me. Just sign here and everything will be over. We don't think you're a bad person. We just think that you got caught up in a bad situation. And it was like, what is going on? All of a sudden, I was trying to be railroaded by these overzealous NCIS agents who were, I think, were trying to just make a name for themselves and corner the young, naive 23-year-old Navy sailor. Luckily, I wasn't stupid and didn't sign any confessions or anything like that, and lawyered up. But they spent the next 9 months literally looking under every rock from Washington, D.C. to Baghdad just to try to find something to charge me with, because I think there was a lot of personal bigotries in the fact that this young female Navy girl was in love with an Iraqi man, and all these people, to a lot of these people, the only good Iraqi was a dead Iraqi. They didn't understand what Fadi had done for our country. They didn't understand who he was. Even prior to me meeting Fadi, he had been working with U.S. Marines and soldiers on the ground in Iraq for 2.5 years. He had suffered combat injuries. He had literally bled on the battlefield for our country. And now he was, because he had fallen in love with an American girl, he was being treated no better than a terrorist. They were accusing him of pumping me for government secrets, or at the very least, he was using me for a green card. So, yeah, we went through hell.
Hey, Amanda, do you think that had it been reversed, that it was an American male sailor and a female translator from Iraq, do you think it would have gotten the same attention that it did?
Unfortunately, I don't think so. I think it definitely was a double standard. I even got all this, all the horrible, you know, why are you with an Iraqi? You're so pretty. What are you doing with an Iraqi? I had to stand a disciplinary review board where I was literally asked by a male chief, out of 300 million Americans to choose from, why do you have to be with an Iraqi? You're a disgrace. And half of the guys in that room were married to foreign women. I think it's just been a thing, you know, men have been bringing home war brides since the dawn of war.
Yeah.
And they're slapped on the back and told attaboy, but when the roles were reversed, a woman brings it home, we're dirty tramps sleeping with the enemy.
Sure. Look at the end of World War II.
And we're
Korea.
Too emotional. We get emotionally involved. So naturally, national secrets are going to fall out of our mouths when we become emotionally involved with somebody.
Yeah. Three or four of my friends in Vietnam married Vietnamese girls. And then there was all the guys who married the Korean girls after Korea, and the guys who were in Japan that married Japanese girls. And what? You know?
Yeah, and it happens all the time. We are quite an anomaly. There really weren't that many marriages, even between, you know, men marrying Iraqi women in you know, these wars, because pretty much all of the interaction done between soldiers and the citizens over there are basically done at the end of a gun. There's no, you know, at the end of the day, you know, they don't go down to the local bar and hang out with the local citizenry like they did in World War II.
Well, no, yeah. And so besides that, you don't know what they look like underneath all that clothing.
Well, yeah, I mean, but there are still women over there that, I mean, that didn't wear, you know, any hijabs or anything like that. I mean, Fadi's Christian. His whole family's Christian. He has a mother and a sister. They never wore any headscarves or anything in Baghdad.
Well, no, because they're Catholic.
Right.
Yeah.
So nowadays they would have to. kind of backslid quite a bit.
Yeah, well.
Hey, tell me, you mentioned that, you know, you had top secret clearance. I've always thought that, like, you know, you hear
don't
about spy. Yeah, I know that's big. My biggest problem. But when you know, somebody's a spy, and you might be a spy for, say, 30 years, and then you go to retire, do you really ever get a chance to step away?
Yeah.
You had top secret clearance. Do you ever get to really step away, or is the government always watching you because they know that you have a lot of secrets you carry around?
Well, I think it depends on who you are. They know that, I mean, I don't have a lot of secrets that I'm carrying around. I mean, I worked at NSA, but you know, the guy that sweeps the floor, I was about one step below him. So I don't have, you know, I don't have a whole lot of stuff, but you never really get to step away in that when you do have a top secret security clearance, you do, you know, sign a paper that be kind of holds you. I think it's like 70 years or something.
Right. And you sign a debriefer
for 70 years.
Yeah, you have to sign a debriefing paper when you get out of the military. That's says you'll never divulge anything that you ever learned.
Right. You're never divulged. And even now, I mean, like I said, I wrote the book and published it 10 years, you know, after getting out of the military, and I still had to send the manuscript to the National Security Agency, where they literally have their a whole department where their job is strictly to read manuscripts written by former employees.
Right.
Even if they're fiction.
Right.
If it has anything to do with, you know, spies or government, they want to make sure that you didn't accidentally say something you weren't supposed to in your fiction novel.
Right.
So, yeah. And then, of course, because of the nature of my work, it had to also get sent to the CIA's readers as well. So everybody in D.C. has read my book, I'm sure.
Well, hell, you know, I got to be making money hand over fist then.
Yeah, right? No, because they all get to read it for free.
Yeah, I know. Those cheap bastards.
Yeah, they all get to, and then they sent it back to me with entire chapters redacted. It was hilarious. I had to write around a whole bunch of stuff. And what was really, really funny was there were things in my book, you know, when I wrote it that I was like, I don't know if this is going to fly. And they left those things in, and then redacted things that were completely ridiculous. Like, really, you got rid of that, but you left this in? I don't think you guys know what you're doing.
Yeah.
No,
it's
that
highly possible.
We see that every day in the news. They don't know what they're
doing. They have no clue what they're doing.
Yeah.
That is an absolute fact. That is an absolute fact. So you're glad you're out of the Navy now. I'm absolutely certain of that.
I am glad, definitely. I mean, my book is not a political statement. A lot of people, when, you know, I have a lot of friends who are still in the Navy, who I was, you know, friends with, you know, while I was in, or we went through boot camp together or DLI together.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, oh, I bet you ripped the Navy up one side and down the other in that book. And I was like, no, I really didn't, because it was split 50-50. There were individuals in the Navy who treated me unfairly, but they did that, I think, due to their own personal bigotries. And then there were also individuals in the Navy who stood up for me, took my side. The XO of my command, actually, who had to preside over my non-judicial punishment and hand out to me a reduction in rank and sentence me to 45 days of restriction. As soon as he got done doing that, he said in front of the whole room, he stepped out from the podium and he shook my hand and he said, "What just happened to you is wrong and I'm sorry."
Wow.
Well, so, I would have to concur with him.
Yeah.
But he had to do something.
Well, he had to. I mean, it was his job to hand out the punishment.
Sure.
Because the CO of the command at the time was actually a woman, and she had recently become the commanding officer of the Naval Command there at Fort Meade at NSA, and she was the first female commanding officer ever of that command.
Mm-hmm.
So she had to be tough on me. Had she gone lenient on me at all, or anybody thought that she was going lenient on me, they'd have nailed her to the wall. So again, it was all politics.
Mm-hmm.
and it was sad.
Well, it's unfortunate too that that you got a discharge general under honorable, but then they took your benefits and you can't be hired by any government agency anymore, not even the post office. I mean, that's pretty sad.
Yeah, that was thanks to the head of the JAG office at the command. He really had it out for me.
Mm-hmm.
I was a disgusting tramp in his eyes. I was a dirty low person. He just, you know, I was a complete disgrace in his eyes. So he was going to do everything he could. He was very, very upset when NCIS closed the case and said, we cannot find anything to charge her with.
Mm-hmm.
He was like, keep looking.
Well, you know, Amanda, the old adage is, if you're going to be a disgusting tramp, be the very best disgusting tramp you can be.
Right. That's great. You know, I got medals in that.
Good girl.
Right. No, but like I said, I mean, for me, the betrayal, I was like, yeah, this sucks. I mean, it's a horrible betrayal, but I really, really felt bad about the betrayal that Foddy faced.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he, after everything he had done, he was just completely betrayed. And it was really a gross miscarriage of justice
right.
But I mean, even today, it's water under the bridge for him. He's like, you know, I understand. And he's a much better person than I.
Right. Well, I mean, I don't want to go into detail about what happened and what went on with him while he was in the Iraqi cell block. However, yeah. It was pretty gruesome.
Yeah, he's been through it, and he's come out the other side. I mean, he's an amazing person.
Well, apparently he is. I mean, you're married to him, and he's doing well in El Cajon, so.
Yeah, he's doing pretty good, and it's so funny, even when people are still like, so what do you say to people that just say that Foddy used you for a green card? And I'm like, well, you know, 2 kids, 10 years of marriage, and a mortgage later, I'd say he got the short end of the stick.
Yeah. It's going to cost him now.
Yeah. He's missing the quiet of war.
Yeah, I'm absolutely certain of that, especially with 2 little ones.
Yes.
Especially girls.
Yes, yes, we have 2 girls, a 10-year-old and a 2-year-old.
Oh, good luck with that.
Yeah.
When your 10-year-old hits 13, find a foxhole and climb in it and pull it in over the top of you until she's 18 or 19.
God, I tell you what, it's
brutal.
Already started.
They're
I mean,
brutal.
They start, it starts earlier and earlier, and I'm like, where's this attitude coming from? You're 10.
Yeah. They can get brutal.
I remember my brother-in-law, when his first daughter was born, she was about 2 years old, and he just told everybody, he says, "And just in case you're interested, she's grounded till she's 45.
I'm a firm believer in first meeting your children when they're 30.
Yeah, oh, at least the daughters.
You know, hi, I'm your dad. And you are? Anyway, back to your book, or at least how much of it you want to talk about at this point. But I do have to say that I thoroughly enjoyed it, Amanda. It was quite a great read.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
It was like, it's a raw book, that's for sure.
Well, it's a good story.
Did you, I noticed that you mentioned earlier, because I had a question that I was going to ask you about how you were able to keep the details, at least it seems so accurate,
right.
But you said that you actually started writing this shortly after you got back and out of the service?
Right, yeah. I started, I kept a journal while I was in Baghdad, so that helped a lot. So I had the journal to go off of as far as, you know, most of my time in country. And then I started writing the actual manuscript 2 months after I returned from Iraq and all of the investigation with the NCIS started and all that good stuff. So I started writing it then. And then, of course, the investigation drug on for 9 months. And then I just continued to keep a journal after that. And then that makes it a lot easier. And then, of course, you know, I mean, it's something that sticks with you.
Well, yeah.
I remember it like it was yesterday.
What was your impetus for having a journal while you were in country?
As far as
just why did you? What was your reason for doing it? I mean, I look back at my life now and I said, "Darn, I wish I'd kept a journal about so many things."
Oh God, not
because
me.
I have an awful memory anyway. But you were
I think I've been a writer at heart probably since I was a kid. And I've kept journals throughout my life, probably since about sixth grade. I've kept, you know, consistently kept journals. So going on this adventure and shipping off and serving, you know, in a war in Iraq, I said, well, I definitely want to document this time in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's going to be significant. they turned out to be really significant. So it was just a natural thing for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, but a journal. Journals are really hard. They're hard for guys because we don't have that attention span to be able to sit down and write every day.
I'm sorry, what were we talking about?
Yeah, I know. See, exactly what I'm talking about.
Squirrel.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Oh, look, it's a rabbit.
Well, Iraq, too, I mean, was, especially the job that I was in, it could be pretty lonely. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you're working, of course, you're busy, but when it's your time off, you're in the middle of
nowhere,
a desert, in the middle of a war.
Right.
You have a lot of alone time and downtime. And also, too, I mean, I didn't deploy with like a unit, with a military unit. So it's not like I was surrounded by fellow unit, you know, members and stuff like that. When you're working that kind of work, it's kind of alone. People rotate in and out at different times. You might have a roommate, but she's only going to be there for 3 weeks, and then she rotates somewhere else. So you're kind of on your own. You travel on your own. I was alone for my entire travel to the country. I was alone for my entire travel out of the country. So it is kind of a solitary existence. So writing, of course, again, was therapeutic for me.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned also that in your spare time, when they would, like I remember you said at one point, they would show movies and they were terribly censored. You said they even censored the word crap.
Yeah.
And I laughed at that. And I was curious, who were the censors? Was it Iraq or was it the U.S.
well,
government that was doing that?
No, that was us. That's the lovely Armed Forces Network that gets typed into all the military bases around the world. And it's run by the military. Typically, a bunch of 18-year-old Air Force guys get up and do the news and all that good stuff.
What did you call the guy that did news? What, or the DJ? What did you call him?
Oh, yeah, I called him something. It was mean.
It was mean.
I can't remember now.
Well, open your book up because it's on page 242. No, I don't know. I'm lying.
It's the Armed Forces, and it's kind of a running joke in the military. Everybody that's in the military that's been deployed overseas is well familiar with the Armed Forces Network, and everybody makes fun of it, I guess.
Right. Yeah, when I was in Vietnam, it was the AFRTS, which is the Armed Forces Radio and Television Network.
Right, and that's, basically it's the same thing. It just got shortened down to AFN, Armed Forces Network.
Right.
It was an interesting conglomeration of radio and television programming. Of course, we didn't have any TV,
right.
So it didn't matter.
Yeah, it's supposed to make the U.S. service members, feel a little closer to home with the connection. It's kind of more obsolete these days in the highly, digitized and globalized world. They're out at camps in the middle of Syria, and they're on the internet, and playing World of Warcraft with each other. these days.
So. I mean, I can't believe that. They're at a camp in the middle of nowhere, and they got email and Netflix and all kinds of stuff.
Yep. Email and Netflix, and they all had PlayStations. That was one thing that Foddy talked about. He's like, no matter where I went, whether I was at a Marine camp in the middle of the desert in Fallujah, or if I was in Baghdad, every time I went or into a barracks or a tent that was occupied by male U.S. Service members, there was a PlayStation. He's like, I was beginning to think that it was some kind of mind control that the government was using for them.
Well, I think you said you took.
Like, you might not be far off.
You took your PlayStation 2 with you, didn't you?
I did.
Yeah.
I don't even think he knows to this day that I had a PlayStation in my room. I totally hid it. I never even told him. I was like, yeah, that's crazy.
Well, I was a radio telephone operator, and at night I had to tune in to AFRTS on my radio, and I could lay there in the bush and listen to the really bad music. But then at 11 o'clock at night, the station would shut down and they would put on pre-recorded stuff. So all night long, you got like really bad music. I mean, bad. So if you were up, you just listened to it. If you most of the time we just shut the radio down and went to sleep. It was pretty sad.
But at least it was something. I mean, if you're in the middle of the jungle or the middle of the desert, I mean, sometimes you're just any kind of link to civilization is kind of nice.
Yeah, but then every half hour, 40 minutes, you get some guy calling you with a commo check, and you go, oh, man, you blew my song.
That was the only good one they played all night.
The only good one they played all night. You gave me squelch.
I'm totally getting into Glenn Miller. Yes.
I'm not that old, Amanda. I'm close, but not quite. Let's talk a little bit about your process. When you were writing this, I got the fact that you started it in a journal. But when you started translating to the written page and you started bringing everything out, what was your day like as you started writing this?
Well, I wrote this book over the course of 6 years.
Right.
I wrote it between having kids, between building a family, between rebuilding my life because I, had walked away from my career, getting my husband, out of Iraq and immigrated to the U.S. So my book was shelved many times and often shelved for extended periods of time. And there were times, there are parts of the book, you've read the book, there's some difficult things in there that are still to this day I can't go back and read. There have been passages, I've done other interviews and people have picked out passages. Oh, we want you to read this passage. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I can't. You're welcome to read it, but I really can't read that. So writing that, you have to relive it. And you have to relive it in a very emotional and real way in your head when you're writing a book.
Sure.
And it was difficult and it was tumultuous.
Oh, I'll bet. Well, and besides the fact that your husband went back to Iraq, five times as a translator? Working as a civilian contractor?
How ironic is that? Yeah, I got completely kicked out of the military for having a relationship with this man and told that I could never have a government employment ever again. And literally, nine months after he immigrates here, the DOD comes knocking on our door and says to my husband, we'd really love for you to come work for us.
I can think of a couple words I would say to the DOD.
I was like, seriously?
It wouldn't be that.
Yeah, he returned
to
the DOD translator.
It'd be like, va fanculo.
All right.
There you go. Anyway.
But yes, so as far as the process goes, I think that I just wrote when I could squeeze it in.
Uh-huh.
And also, too, I wrote until I couldn't write anymore, until it got a little too emotional or got too difficult.
Uh-huh.
And then I'd have to shelf it. There were times when that book was shelved for 6 month stretches.
Uh-huh.
And I think a lot of people think, if I shelf a project for 6 months, then it's dead. And I think that that's kind of a big message I try to send to aspiring writers, is that just because you had to shelf it or you had to walk away from it, even for a long time, doesn't mean that it's dead in the water.
Right.
You can always go back. You can always continue. It's just about not giving up.
Right.
And you can still turn it into something beautiful.
Right. Well, the story's still there. The story doesn't
go
away.
Exactly. Mine definitely wasn't going anywhere.
Yeah. You know, I often think that I've never written anything autobiographical. There you go. It's that word entrepreneur. I can't say that either. Autobiographical. I imagine, though, a lot of the times when you're sitting there and you're getting into something that is emotional, that I think that I feel that would be the time when you could really, really, really put it down. I mean, really put your emotions on the air, on the paper.
It is, and that's what makes it a good story. But it's still difficult.
Yeah.
It's hard to do it. It's hard to relive it. You're absolutely right. That's what makes it a good story. That's what makes it captivating.
Right.
And that's what a lot of people ask me. They're like, well, if you could recommend, because you have two books, my second book, Voice in the Eagle, is finished now. And they said, if you could recommend somebody to read one book, which book would you recommend? And I said, well, the second one is a lot better written than the first one, because I was a 23-year-old, un-college-educated, writing from the heart person, mm-hmm. whereas my second book is a lot more refined, a much more mature writer. But I still would recommend my first one because it's raw, it's emotional, it's gonna take you on a journey that something only that kind of unique story can take you on.
Mm-hmm. I found your first one, A Foreign Affair, pretty well written, actually.
Thank you.
Sure.
I guess I'm the biggest critic. I go back and I read it and I'm like, what did you do here?
You know, we all find every single mistake in the manuscript.
We do.
And the truth is, if you get a book from, what's the big publisher? Simon & Schuster. You're going to find typos. You're going to find mistakes in everything that's ever printed. So, you can't nail yourself on stuff like that.
But you know,
and it kind of makes it, that those nuances are kind of also what makes it yours.
Well, yeah.
And they make it unique.
That's true.
And it's, stuff like that. Whereas with my second book is my husband's story.
Right.
About the time that he spent, working with the Marines and the Army and all that stuff. And he had told me, bits and pieces of his different experiences. And it just got to the point, I was like, you have a really unique story and a really interesting perspective of mm-hmm. the war.
Mm-hmm.
You should write a book. I'm going to write your book. So I literally would have to, I'd sit down with him. I'd have a recorder and I would basically do informal interviews with him where we would just have conversations, mm-hmm. and talk about, things that had happened. And I would just record everything literally on my iPhone. And oftentimes I'd have to, grease him up with some Jack Daniels to get him to talk about some certain things. Because, I mean, he went through quite a bit of, traumatic things as well mm-hmm. that's difficult for him to relive and even talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But I needed it. I needed to get it out of him. And then I would go and transcribe the interview, and then I would go back to those transcriptions, and then I turned those transcriptions into a manuscript.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to tell you that the bug I sent you, it does hold Jack Daniels.
Awesome. He'll be super excited.
Tell me, from the timeline of the new book
mm-hmm.
versus the one that you did, this first one, is there a crossover?
Overlap. It's basically a pretty straightforward prequel to A Foreign Affair.
Okay.
It goes up to and ends basically right when he and I meet.
Oh, okay. So that's the link.
And then it basically says, for the rest of this story, you can see A Foreign Affair.
There you go. I like it.
Yeah, so, and it starts back. I mean, he started working for the U.S. Army just a couple of months after the fall of Saddam. An army convoy literally rolled into his residential neighborhood in Baghdad. He lived in an upper middle class, you know, neighborhood. They were still going house to house looking for WMDs at the time. Mm-hmm. So they roll into this neighborhood and leave it to the United States military to go invade a country and forget to bring along anybody that speaks the language. The convoy had no translator. And they're going house to house into these Iraqis' homes, patting down the women, going through the underwear drawers. It was causing some tension.
Oh, I'll bet.
Because they didn't understand the Iraqis. The Iraqis didn't understand these soldiers walking into their houses with, you know, automatic rifles and touching their wives. The soldiers weren't doing anything wrong by American standards. But by Iraqi standards, it wasn't good. So Fadi could see the tension building between his neighbors and the soldiers. The leader of the unit was an army captain. He could see the tension building as well. So he literally started walking down the middle of the street screaming, "Does anybody here speak English? Does anybody here speak English that can help us?" And Fadi knew he was the only one in the neighborhood who spoke English because he was majoring in English at the University of Baghdad. So he went out and he said, "Look, I can speak a little bit of English. I'll help you out." So he helped that unit for that day clear the houses, you know, do the houses up and down the street. And at the end of the day, the army captain looked at Fadi and said, "Would you like a job? Because I'd really like you to come work for us." And the army captain, I'm pretty sure, paid Fadi out of his pocket for the first few months, simply because he knew how valuable, how much he needed Fadi, how much he needed a translator.
Sure.
And the Americans weren't providing any. Yeah. I mean, we were really short. I mean, we were pretty slim on Arabic translators. So he paid Fadi, you know, out of his pocket for the first few months.
But you know,
and then, so Fadi, do what?
I was just going to say, how friggin' irresponsible of the government to not send translators into a foreign country. I mean, that would be one of the first things I'd think about. Okay, who's going to communicate?
Well, they did. They did send translators in, but the thing is, they just didn't have enough to go out with all of these little units that were rolling into neighborhoods and doing house-to-house searches. They just didn't have enough to send with each unit.
Mm-hmm,
so some units, they were like, you know, so bad, so sad, good luck.
Yeah, but just think how easily things
really
could have gone south.
Well, that's the six P's of military thinking. Prior planning prevents piss-poor performance.
Exactly. There was no planning. Well know, there was no planning for after Saddam went down. We had no idea what we were going to do afterwards. And it's sad to think how many maybe firefights broke out or clashes erupted simply because of a lack of communication between the U.S. military and the people of the area. Fadi has no doubt that his neighbors would have, I mean, because everybody in Iraq is armed. Everybody has an AK-47 in their house. It's just home security.
Sure.
So he has no doubt that there would have been a major firefight erupt between that unit and probably some of his pissed off neighbors.
More than likely.
Over what was happening. Had he not stepped in and kind of, you know, communicated.
I used to have a sign on my wall in my office, and it says, "Failure to plan on your part does not constitute an emergency in my part."
Like that.
Yes, this is true.
Okay,
unfortunately, the failure to plan caused a lot of emergencies.
There you go. Hey, look, we only got a couple minutes left. Why don't you tell our listeners where they can reach you, how they can reach you, email, Twitter,
private
Facebook.
Private cell phone number.
Private cell phone number. Address. No. Don't, no address, no phone number.
Send courier pigeon, too.
Okay.
I'm everywhere. I have my website. It's pretty easy. It's Amanda Matty, MATTI.com. I'm on Facebook at author Amanda Matty. Both of my books each have their own Facebook page, A Foreign Affair and Voicing the Eagle. I'm on Twitter at Amanda Matty. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Pinterest. You name it, I'm on there. I'm out there. Of course, the book is on Amazon, A Foreign Affair. And then on my website, there's, of course, contact forms. If you want to send me a direct email, it's Amanda@AmandaMatty.com.
Very cool. Here's one last question for you real quick. Have you ever had writer's block?
Yes. I'll tell you right now, my number one fighter of writer's block is lots and lots of Enya music.
Oh, there you go. That works. That's got to work for you.
India all the time. Ornica flow, baby.
Amanda, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's been a hoot.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, we loved having you. It was fun. It was fun. And I hope your second book does well. Your book now is, of course, A Foreign Affair, and it's available on Amazon and all the online booksellers, I am sure.
Yes.
And any bookstores it's available in, especially down in San Diego?
It's at barnesandnoble.com. It's at a couple of local bookstores here in San Diego. I'll be doing book signings at Warwick's here in San Diego in April. But if you just ask for it, if they don't have it, you ask for it, anybody can get it.
Okay, good enough. Thanks again for joining us, Amanda Matty. And her book is A Foreign Affair. Thanks, Amanda.
Thank you.
Okay, good bye-bye. Night.
Bye.
Amanda Matty.
What energy. I like her.
Quite a young lady.
I would have liked to have had her in the studio.
Me too.
Because that energy was just really coming.
We might have just kicked for another hour.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, my gosh. She is fun. She is fun. And I just, you know, I wanted to say something about Russ Avison tonight.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, something good.
You had to search for that.
Russ has a couple of businesses in Ventura County, and one of them is All Dogs Rule, which is a boarding facility in Fillmore on how many acres? 20 acres?
Yeah, just about 20.
20 acres? Uh-huh. Great place. A lot of dirt. Fun dogs. And then but he also is a dog trainer, and his website and the name of his dog training business is Canine
Logic.
Right. And it's caninelogic.net.
Right. And it's canine spelled out.
Canine, like C-A-N-I-N-E,
right.
logic.net. And if you're needing to train a dog, I got to tell you, my dog, believe me, she was untrainable. No, she wasn't untrainable. My dog is a golden retriever, and they're all over the board.
Belzer.
And she actually took four of Russ's classes and came out in flying colors, so... She's good, and Russ is good. Russ is, like, one of the best.
She helped you look good.
Yeah, she did. She's such a clown. Anyway, that's it for us tonight. Russ, thank you so much for being in the studio.
Thank you, as always. Love it.
Oh, etch, man, we'll see you for Thursday in April.
Yes, sir.
And with that being said, thank you again for joining us on The Writer's Block, and we are out of here.